All right, and you are Miss, is it pronounced Jarman or Jarman? You may proceed.
This case began with a 7-count indictment. Mr. Church was indicted for several sex crimes. Mr. Church went through the Rule 11 colloquy with the district court, and afterwards he filed a motion to withdraw his guilty plea. It's our contention that under the Carr factors set out by this court, the district court abused its discretion in denying Mr. Church his request to withdraw the guilty plea. There are 7 Carr factors that this court set out. Number one.
Before you just go through the list, so there is no argument of sentencing error and there is no argument of prosecutorial misconduct breach. This is just a straightforward Carr. Your argument is there was a just and fair reason that you should have been able to withdraw the guilty plea. Is that correct?
The argument is that the prosecutor suggested during the plea that there would be the total offense level for count one would be a 30. So there was some confusion there, and the prosecutor made clear to the district court that it was prosecuting for counts 2, 3, and 4 under 1591B2, which would have set the offense level at 30.
But am I right that, I mean, the only count that seems implicated by this confusion is count one, because that's the only one there was reference to B1, the force enhancement. We're talking about count one?
We're talking.
Disagree with me if you do, because I don't, the substantive counts were all.
Yes, we're talking about all counts, because in his motion to withdraw and in his argument before the district court, Mr. Church argues that he did not understand what he was pleading guilty to at the plea.
Right, I know, but that was sort of a confused dialogue, and I don't see how that would fit into any of the Carr factors. Disagree if you do. What was difficult and confused the rearrangement was that the government interjected and said, we want to clarify something orally. Count one, which says it's a 1594 conspiracy plea to violate 1591, he then said, but not the force enhancement.
Right, and I believe that is where some confusion came into the other counts as well, because Mr. Church, you know, a layperson, of course, I think the whole argument there confused him in terms of the counts.
I don't want to ask too many questions, but I do have one. Do you have a Carr case where there's no dispute about the knowing and voluntary plea to an offense, 1591, but there is confusion about agreement to a penalty enhancement? Because B1 is only a penalty enhancement, right? It's not a separate offense. So he pled knowingly to the conspiracy, and this is how I see it, so disagree. Conspiracy count one, each substantive act, but there was confusion about should he get enhanced to a level 34 instead of a level 30. And I'm wondering, can you get out of a plea because you're not clear about what facts will be shown for sentencing? Do you see, is that clear? Is that a question you can answer? Or?
I don't have a case specifically on that.
Okay.
But I believe that could be answered under the knowing and voluntarily, because I think that is a part of the whole picture of did he knowingly and voluntarily under Rule 11 give a plea.
May I ask a question, hopefully to try to simplify what I think is going on in this case? As I understand it, your client never intended to plead guilty to force and fraud.
Correct.
Right? That is the central point.
Correct.
He wanted to plead guilty to the 14 to 18-year-old aspect, but made clear there's no force or fraud that he's pleading guilty to.
That is what the prosecutor presented to the district court.
Right, but I'm just, in terms of your client was fully ready and did in fact think he was pleading guilty to the 14 to 18.
To be honest, I'm not sure
what
his thought process was, because I did not handle the case at the trial level. But according to the record, he basically went before the district court and said he did not understand generally what he was pleading guilty to, and that there was some confusion, as Your Honor pointed out, as to what the total offense level would have been.
Okay, but just without getting into offense levels and all that, because I agree with you, a non-lawyer and even lawyers can get all that confused. Just on a very simplified point, though, as I understood it, your client obviously pled guilty to something. He was ready to plead guilty, avoid trial to something. I'm trying to figure out what that is. And as I understand it, he was saying, I plead guilty to 14 to 18-year-old, but I do not plead guilty to force or fraud. Is that fair or is that mistaken?
I have to stand on what he said in the record. In the record, Mr. Church said that he really wasn't sure what he pled guilty to. That is what he told the district court at the evidentiary hearing. That's his statement.
Yeah, it got a little, his lawyer started speaking and focused mostly on the force. And then he did interject, and it was a little more confused. It's hard for me to say there's reversible error on Carr just because a defendant says, I'm really not sure what I pled to, because he signed it, and he went through the Boykin colloquy. But to me, the confusion is the government's interjection orally and saying, well, he signed a plea agreement, and we charged B1 force, but now I'm telling you, no force.
And the other part of that,
but where, if that's all it is, where does that get your client? Because, right, he ends up 400 months consecutive on all four, right? And even the, so I guess I'm wondering, it would seem to me that what your client doesn't want is a judgment and conviction saying he pled to forcibly trafficking minors. But that would be something maybe, given the government's brief, we'll hear from them in a minute, they would agree with you that we should modify the J&C to strike reference to B1. Is that really what you want, that his criminal record doesn't reflect forcibly trafficking children?
Actually, at the district court level, Mr. Church and his lawyer argued that he did not, he asserted his innocence of everything. That was his argument at the district court level.
Right. Now you, I mean, the PSR is full of facts of violence, especially against Ms. Marks, correct? And
the PSR states that, but Mr. Carr's assertion is even before he gets to the sentencing and the PSR that he was innocent altogether.
Okay.
Under the Carr factors.
Right. I'm just saying, even, let's imagine there was a lot of violence in this conspiracy. It was forcible sex trafficking of children. Am I correct? The government and you couldn't agree to just take a position that those facts don't exist. So the probation department had to do its own independent analysis of the facts. And if it involves force, wouldn't B1 apply no matter what you pled to?
That's what the probation department.
Right, that's what they did.
In the second.
Right. And that's what the sentencing court did. It said, you know, I find force. I see force, I think.
Right, but that goes back to Mr. Carr's confusion at the Rule 11 hearing when the prosecutor interjected there.
It's a little, yeah. You go on with your argument. Did you have more points, or did you think you've sort of?
Well, I wanted to add that under the Carr factors also, if there was any delay in bringing the motion to withdraw, his trial counsel argued that he had been away and had not actively been communicating with his client, so we want to ask the court not to prejudice him in that regard, and that it would not really inconvenience the government, it would not have at the time inconvenienced the government to allow him to withdraw the plea because the witnesses were there.
The relief you want is back to square one. He's facing trial, all four counts, possible life sentence. That's what he wants.
Mr. Church's argument is that he is innocent of the charges and he'd rather have a trial.
Okay. You've reserved time for rebuttal. Thank you. You've been in front of me before. Is it Ms. Maines?
Ms. Maines.
Maines.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the court. There are two issues that the government raised in its briefing. One is the Mr. Church's appeal waiver. Is it valid and enforceable? The answer is yes, and the court really doesn't need to reach the second question, which is, did the district court act within its discretion in denying the defendant's motion to withdraw? There's really an overarching issue here, though, between both the appeal waiver and the motion to withdraw, and that's the voluntariness of the plea. I don't think that...
So if the voluntariness of the plea is at even remotely at play, we wouldn't enforce an appeal waiver because the appeal waiver is a provision in the plea agreement.
Your Honor, there are cases on that. The published cases that the court has on that often deal with an assertion of ineffective assistance, which is an exception to...
It involves government misconduct and the confection of the plea. Maybe my colleagues have questions. I'd love to hear your answer. It's very unusual because the government suggested at rearrangement to orally modify the plea. But the plea itself prohibits that. So right there, you've got a breach of the plea agreement. Do you disagree with that?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I'd have to think about that. I know that has not been...
The final clause says there are no oral modifications. And at rearrangement, the government says we're going to modify what he pled to. He pled to a B1, we charged a B1, but we're telling you there is no force.
I will say the written plea, I don't think that the intent was a modification. The written plea reflected, at least for counts 2, 3, and 4, the substantive counts, that it was a B2.
But then the AUSA gets up and says, no, I just want to clarify there's no force even as to conspiracy.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you charged force, and the signed plea agreement was force.
That's right, Your Honor.
So that's a modification.
Yes. So,
finish your point, and then I'll...
I was going to say, we'll go ahead and reach beyond the appeal waiver, and I can talk about the actual challenge to the...
That's where we're going.
Right.
Yes.
Is it the government's position that Mr. Church intended to plead guilty, but intended to plead guilty only as to the 14 to 18-year-old and not as to force or fraud?
I think the party's understanding was that he was pleading guilty to B2, which is the 14
right.
to 18.
What is the, I think what I'm hearing from opposing counsel, that was my understanding as well. I think what I've heard from opposing counsel today is that in fact there was no such desire to plead guilty. He was confused the entire time and he's always insisted on his innocence. Here's my question. What is the best record evidence, ROA site, that you could provide us that Mr. Church did in fact intend to plead guilty to the 14 to 18, and the only issue is just sticking in the B1, and from what I could tell, Scrivener's error, it just accidentally stuck in B1. What is the best evidence that was Mr. Church's understanding?
Beyond the rearrangement transcript, you can look at the sentencing transcript. The record is 603 and 615. Mr. Church's attorney says, Mr. Church is not maintaining his total innocence. And then the attorney goes on to say he's disputing the characterizations in the PSR. And then when Mr. Church allocutes, he says, like my lawyer said, I'm not innocent in this. That's record at 617. On the next page, he refers to his sex trafficking activities as, quote, a week of stupidity. He is not asserting actual innocence. When he was...
And I'm sorry, where is the personal? That's at 615?
The attorney statements are at 603 and 615. Mr. Church's statements are at 617 and 618.
And 18?
18, yes.
I guess before you even get to Carr, right, Rule 11D is what governs withdrawals. And up to sentencing, you can withdraw for any fair and just reason.
Yes, Your Honor.
So he's saying the fair and just reason he should have been able to withdraw is because he didn't do it with force, and the government is now agreeing he didn't do it with force, but he was charged having done it with force.
Your Honor, I wouldn't characterize it as that. What happened was Mr. Church received the PSR. Mm-hmm. He sees it, says, eesh, this is not what I was expecting. And so he has a challenge to, he has objections to the PSR. The probation officer used the wrong base offense level. The probation officer assessed all these enhancements.
But the probation officer and the district court gave him level 34 because he pled to a B1. That's what it says in the guidelines.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's triggered by the plea.
And
he pled to B1, but the AUSA, probably not you, specifically said there isn't that trigger.
Yes. But that still does not meet the Carr factors. That should have been an issue fleshed out at sentencing. And it was, the frustrating thing I think here is for the court and frankly for me is that it was fleshed out very much in the motion to withdraw the plea. The government says both in its response to the motion and at the hearing, Hey, we agree that the base offense level should be a 30.
Right, but when you say it's frustrating, it wasn't fleshed out at sentencing, it was the government's obligation to object at sentencing too. The government should never have let this district judge apply force if it didn't think there was evidence to support it and there was no guilty plea to be won. The government just stays silent.
It did, and
then you're trying to invoke the appeal waiver to further insulate it. That's why I'm a little confused by the government's position here.
I understand, Your Honor, and I think that, as the court suggested, when appellee counsel was up, that perhaps it requires a modification in the judgment. But what it doesn't require is a reversal and a whole redo.
So I want to follow up on my record questions. I see 617, 618, he's definitely not claiming innocence.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you have, and so thank you for that. My next record question is, where do you have him agreeing that he wants to plead guilty to the 14 to 18-year-old aspect, but specifically not to force or fraud? Do you have that?
I do not have a cite for that. And what happens at the rearrangement hearing, Your Honor, is that the prosecutor begins walking through the elements of the charge. The second prosecutor steps in, says, I want to make clear, B2, not B1. The defendant says he understands, and then the court has the prosecutor go through the elements again a few pages later, and I can get you the cites for those if you'd like. And the defendant says, yes, I agree. And when the prosecutor goes through the elements, he says 14 to 18 under B2. But the defendant never says, oh, it's not B1.
Essentially what you have is the government is reciting this into the record, and Church is agreeing that he's not innocent and that he is pleading guilty.
That is correct.
Okay.
Yes.
So given that essentially this entire mess is essentially, from what I can tell, a sloppy plea agreement that stuck in the words B1 when it shouldn't have, is the proper remedy severance? In other words, just sever the B1 part of it and be done with this case?
That's possibly a remedy, yes, Your Honor. I haven't thought about that, but.
Wait, we'll end up talking about this, but think about it for a minute.
I need to.
How do we sever on appeal?
Would that be sent back then?
That's what I'm asking, if the government has a position on this.
Because you charged B1. It's in the indictment. And then he signs
yes.
a plea to it.
Yes.
And there's then a sentence on it. And then there's a J&C on it.
Yes.
So B1's there from start to finish.
Yes. I would need to get back to the court. Yes. I think that would require some.
I mean, the vision I have is essentially, somebody copied and pasted from one document into the plea agreement and forgot to delete B1.
Yes, and I.
So if that's basically what happened here, the question is, what do we do about it?
This was the morning of trial. The defendant decides to plea. They're putting together a plea agreement so that they can go before the court, and likely it was a copying error.
And for what it's worth, the plea agreement, that's not the only typo. They refer the defendant as her.
Often.
And I mean, it's just, if nothing else, this is sloppy, not by you personally, but sloppiness by the government.
I understand, yes. I've noticed that as well, Your Honor.
Does the government believe that we can enforce a plea agreement that everybody, the prosecution, the defense, the judge, that everybody misunderstood?
I think the plea agreement is enforceable potentially with a written modification, which should have occurred well before it reached this court. And I do think that the plea agreement, ultimately, what happened was he pled to B2 for the substantive counts, B1 and B2 for the conspiracy, which that was not the understanding, and then was sentenced to life. There's an error in the PSR because of the base offense level. Should have been 34, but the error ends up being harmless at the end of the day because his guidelines range was so high.
And the sixth car factor is whether the plea was knowing and voluntary.
Yes, Your Honor.
The Supreme Court has said the Due Process Clause requires that pleas be knowing and voluntary. So it seems that factor of all of them, that factor ought to be entitled to the most weight, right?
I certainly think it's one of the most important, Your Honor, yes.
But I take it your point is it's a harmless violation if it's a violation.
That is right, yes.
And that, is that because he didn't intend to, he, as you say, he was not claiming innocence, quite the opposite, he was admitting guilt.
Yes.
He's just signing a document that is incorrect technically.
And I think the understanding, and that's what very much can be enforced, is the understanding he is pleading to B2, to three counts, substantive counts, B2, and a conspiracy count. And the calculations would have ended up at a total guidelines range of 43.
Hypothetically, let's say we disagree. What happens in the event that the plea is taken away and sounds like we're going to trial?
I think so, is that you would find that the plea is uninformed because of the error, presumably.
Is the government prepared to retry this case? Or not to retry, to try?
We would try it, yes.
The witnesses are available?
Most of them are available. They've moved on with their lives. I mean, the offense was 5 years ago, I believe now. They were minor victims at the time. We are in contact with most of them. We would find them. Some of the co-defendants are still in jail, but it would be very challenging, I guess is what I'm getting at.
Why is that?
Because to gather everybody up, to pull co-defendants out, make people's memories fade.
Is that part of our analysis, whether it's challenging for you or not?
I mean, one of the Carr factors is prejudice to the government and the extent of delay. And so we're not looking at a 10-month delay, which was the original delay.
I've got three questions about
that. And in fairness, she's responded to my questions.
So. Yes. Go ahead, Judge Higginson.
Counts 2 to 4 were only as to B2, correct?
That is correct.
So do you know any Carr law where, maybe it's the severance point, where this appeal only relates to count one, that we would vacate and remand as to count one, conspiracy, but leave intact counts 2 to 4, the substantive counts? Are you urging that, and do you have any law to allow us to do that?
I am not urging it.
Okay.
Then this, I have a case I could say.
Okay. The second, but you see my interest in it. It seems to me this confusion related only to count one. The second, do you know of any Carr law that says the sixth factor, knowing and voluntary plea, attaches to a guilt, a penalty provision, right? Any confusion he had as to B1 or B2 is purely a penalty enhancement. The offense is 1591A, right? B is, by its own textual statement, a penalty provision.
Yes.
So part of what's confused me here is why are we applying Carr to a penalty enhancement, which the district court and the probation would be obliged to apply if there was violence in this conspiracy?
So the probably the closest case I could point you to right now, and it's not in the briefs, is United States versus Scott. The record or the reporter cite for it is 857 F3rd 241. It's a 2017 case from this court. And it actually involved a claim of breach of the plea agreement and enforceability, so some similar issues here. There the court held that the government is not obligated to provide the defendant with all the evidence to be used at sentencing. It discusses the prosecutor's obligation, obviously, to protect an ongoing investigation and recognizes that the government has an obligation to turn over all evidence to probation.
Okay, I'll look at it, but are you arguing to us even if there was confusion, it had nothing to do with what he pled guilty to, the offense?
Yes, Your Honor, because I think the confusion centers around this base offense level issue. I mean, that's when...
Okay, so you're saying Carr is inapplicable altogether?
I mean, there's a Carr claim, but ultimately... There's a Carr claim. Yes, excuse me. But what's really the issue is the sentencing calculation error.
I didn't see that clear in your brief.
I understand.
The Carr has nothing to do with the issue before us.
Yes, but I think that's really the focus of the base offense level 30 versus 34.
My last question is, when you adopted that maybe you're making a harmlessness argument, can an error as to withdrawing a guilty plea ever be harmless under Rule 11H? In other words, the person wants to go to trial. How could an error on Rule 11D, whether you can withdraw or not, ever be harmless?
I think in this case it can, because if you look at the relief requested by the defendant in his motion to withdraw, it was either withdrawal of the plea or specific performance from the government, i.e., we want the government to advocate for a base offense level of 30. If you look back at that motion on the last page, that's what they're advocating for. And that's where the harmlessness analysis would apply, because the relief they requested was not, oh, I want to go to trial. At that time, it was, I either want to go to trial or I want a base offense level of 30. And ultimately, the base offense level of 30 doesn't change the calculus for sentencing.
Can I follow up on one of Judge Higginson's earlier questions? As I think I understand the issue, count one is the only thing at issue here, right? That's the only one that has B1. So we still have 2, 3, 4. Pardon me, because I should know the answer to this. If, let's say, count one just went away, and all that's left is a plea of guilty to 2, 3, and 4, what does that do to the sentence?
It shouldn't do anything. There was a, well, so we'll just use the, they'll all calculate out to the same. It'll be a base offense level of 30 instead of 34.
So still 33 and a third years? I think that's
yes.
What it was, right?
400 months. And right. He would also lose.
So severance of just count one altogether would be, assuming that's.
Special assessment, though.
Right. There's
collateral consequences of now having a B1 on his record.
Yeah. Yes. To the extent it's any different from having.
Well, it's forcibly. Trafficking
but,
children in sex.
Yes.
I mean, they're all awful, but that's more awful.
It is a more serious penalty, as you've noted, yes. But, and then I believe one other thing I'd like to note is that because it was a conspiracy charge, there was a +3 for the 3 pseudo counts, so that would go away. But you would still be way above an offense level of 43. So there are some changes that would happen.
Right. So the sentence would presumably stay the same, the prison term, but there would be these collateral aspects once the judgment were to be corrected along these lines. Got it.
Would the court like me to address any of the CAR factors further or any other questions? If not, I'll take a seat.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Rebuttal argument.
I think the main issue here is that under Rule 11 and under the Supreme Court precedent, a defendant ought to know what he's pleading guilty to, if he's pleading guilty at all. And when the prosecutor here inserted B1 versus B2, it lended to confusion. And whether Mr.
But I'm just going to test that a little bit. Your client definitely knew he was charged with B1 and he signs a B1 plea. The only thing that happens is the government does something the plea doesn't allow the government to do. It interjects orally to your client's benefit and says, we don't think this is a force case. So I'm still a little unsure that meant he gets to undo what he signed that he did.
We contend that based upon the record, he did not understand fully because of that interjection and because of the confusion and the lack of being voluntary plea.
Do you agree with me the plea says anything anyone says orally has no effect on the plea?
Correct.
So he knew that, his counsel knew it. The district court probably, that's why the district court just ignored the government.
But his argument is that he didn't understand it, despite of what the plea.
I think his argument has to be he had understood it, he signed to the more serious offense, but that little remark suddenly made him unsure? Is that what he's arguing?
Yes, and I believe that based upon Rule 11, this court should allow Mr. Church to make the decision as to whether he wants to replea or go to trial.
As to all the counts?
Yes.
Even though the second, third, and fourth have nothing to do with B1?
Well, I think that the confusion probably applies to the entire plea agreement for Mr. Church.
If the government had never interjected, would we be here?
Probably not, Your Honor. Thank you for your time.
Well, you got a little more time. I'm just thinking hard about this because so really the relief you want is he gets back to square one. He doesn't have the benefit of his plea. He doesn't get the downward departure. He's now exposed to life. They've got the evidence they've got. I mean, someone negotiated a plea. He signed that plea. The only issue is a sentencing provision, which I'm still confused. I think he'd probably have to get anyway if the force is in the record.
Now, to be honest with the court on that note, I've spoken to my client
you
about
have.
That.
Okay.
And that is his
That's
position.
All you need to say. If you spoke to him and his position is that he wants to try to...
However, I would like to add that post this argument, I would ask the court to give me more time to...
Well, that makes sense.
Yes.
You've heard us inquiring, at
yes.
least you've heard me inquiring about whether relief might be both parties want us to exercise our authority statutorily to modify the J&C so it would reflect that count one was not with force. That might be a possibility. So you want more time to talk to your client and the government.
If I might add, that that we're discussing now troubled me up to the argument, to the oral argument. And I did everything that I possibly could to communicate effectively, but because of the coronavirus issues and where he's housed, it just fell apart. It took me, I can't tell the court how much time to even get a phone call, a limited phone call with my client.
We'll stay one second. Wonderful. Thank you. You've both been very helpful and appreciate being court appointed very much for your work.
I do have one question, Your Honor. Is this court agreeing to stay a decision?
Well, I think what's likely to happen is you'll receive a call from the mediation attorney with our counsel that will assist you and find out what other if there's any reason for discussions among the parties, and that'll give you time to talk to your client.
Thank
so
you,
no decision Your Honor. Will issue until we hear back from him.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. The case is submitted, and that concludes the session. Thank you very much.